I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Abandoned homes are an unwelcome fact of life in Kansas City, and for decades, residents have been after officials to do something about them. Today, we'll see how two organizations are teaming up to address those derelict residences by turning them into affordable housing. It's an unlikely partnership that wants to help rehabbers and neighborhood associations get that process going. Then, a conversation with the man many credit for making Kansas City a regular stop for the touring versions of Broadway shows. It's time to shine the spotlight on the Theater League's Mark Edelman. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Abandoned homes are a common sight in many American cities. Ours is no exception, but a new nonprofit partnership could soon make blight a little more rare in some neighborhoods east of Troost. In what seems like an unlikely partnership, a legal services organization has teamed up with a community development financial institution and a team of lawyers to create what they're calling the Kansas City Social Investment Pool. Here to explain what that means are Judge Jerry Venters. He's chair of the board of directors of Legal Aid of Western Missouri. It provides legal services to low-income Missourians in the western part of our state. Judge, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Ruben Alonzo is the president of AltCap. That's the Community Development Financial Institution I just mentioned. They are based in Kansas City, and they work to connect and provide small businesses and entrepreneurs to resources and funding. Ruben, nice to have you, too. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
So let's start with the broad brushstrokes here, and then we'll dig in a little more deeply here. What is the social investment pool, Judge, and how does it work exactly?
The pool is made up of a collection of $200,000 that has been put together by socially conscious individuals in the community, investors who have put money into the pool. And that pool will then be used to finance rehabbers to rehab abandoned houses in the city, inner city.
You have $200,000. I'm just guessing here that you'd like to see that amount grow with time.
This is our initial effort, and yes, we'd like to see it grow. How about multiple numbers? We can move the needle a lot more with much more money.
As you both well know, urban blight is a huge problem to take a run at. Ruben, what makes you think that an initiative like this one can help make a dent?
Yeah, I think it allows us to do two things. One, improve neighborhoods and dealing with or addressing what is essentially an epidemic in our urban core neighborhoods with the number of abandoned vacant homes that exist. So helping to rehab those homes, but the way we're doing it by financing small contractors who, you know, create jobs in the community, they buy materials, they create that economic impact to support communities. You know, that's another aspect of this program that we're really excited about, to support those entrepreneurs, those small contractors who are going to be rehabbing these homes.
You know, the numbers, at least initially, in terms of the number of homes you'll rehab are fairly small, but again, that's the beginning. It's not the end point.
Yeah. This is a pilot program for us. So, we have some matching loan funds that we're going to contribute to this effort. We have a generous contribution by First Federal Bank to support the program as well. So we think we can pilot this and scale this up to hopefully attract more investors, more capital to support this. The land bank claims that there is over 5,000 abandoned homes, vacant homes in the urban core. So there's a lot of work to be done here.
5,000. And how many houses will you knock off over the first few years you do this?
Yeah, you know, with $200,000 plus, you know, some of our matching funds, we plan these to be very short-term loans. So we're going to revolve those funds as much as we can, looking at probably six-month loans. I think this is just the tip of the iceberg with this program.
It, realistically, can you see it growing in a dramatic way, Judge? I mean, can you see this thing, this source of money becoming sort of the focal point of a much larger effort here? Because you're looking at, what, half a dozen homes over 3 years, roughly.
Well, hopefully 20 homes or so over 3 years.
Okay.
Because of the revolving nature of this. It's kind of a microcredit program. But yes, to answer your question, yes, absolutely. We think that as more and more socially interested individuals hear about the program, they'll want to contribute and have an impact. Reuben and I were just talking before the show that this is really a first for Kansas City in the innovative nature and in the nature of social impact investing. We believe there are a lot of people out there who are willing to invest if they have the vehicle. They don't have to expect a return. They hopefully will get their money back.
Yeah.
But they're not going to get a big interest rate. But we think there are a lot of individuals who are willing to do this if they know about it.
Reuben, other cities are already doing something similar?
I think a lot of cities are trying to figure out how to address the abandoned vacant home issue. Some have just been demolishing, homes.
Which we've been doing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I've tried that approach as well, but I think there's a part of our community that wants to preserve some of these homes, use it to provide affordable housing, bring people back to the core, increase the population in the core again, and kind of revitalizing these neighborhoods.
Jerry, this sounds like a simple process. You want to rehab abandoned homes, but help us understand some of the legal hurdles here that neighborhood groups have to jump through to acquire and sell an abandoned home, because it's not necessarily simple.
It's not simple at all. Legal aid attorneys have been representing neighborhood associations for decades in trying to address the issues of abandoned homes. When a home sits abandoned for months and months, if the neighborhood association requests our help, then we can have an attorney bring a legal action. You have to find the owner, hopefully, somewhere in the country. And then bring a legal action to either compel them to bring the property up to speed or try to take title.
How difficult is it even finding some of these owners?
I understand it's very, very difficult. Fortunately and happily, that was not my area of legal practice because I think it would be very, very difficult. But as we read and hear, many of these owners just disappear. And so it's very, very difficult to find them. And so if you can't find them, then you have to publish notices and jump through a lot of legal hoops, and it takes several months in order to get that done. So it's not an easy process. It's not a simple process, but that's what we're there to do to get that done.
So we're talking this morning about a new fund called the Kansas City Social Investment Pool aimed at rehabbing abandoned homes. Reuben, you've got to buy the property first. That costs money. Then you've got to make the place livable, and that costs money. Are there loans intended for both of these types of expenses?
Exactly. And, what's also a challenge is getting the financing, typically from, traditional financial institutions that most, small contractors, small businesses already have a hard time accessing capital. So that's where we step in. In this instance, you've got, again, a property that may not have a clear title or has liens that need to be addressed. That's where, where legal aid is bringing those resources and services to help address that. So that property is not available potentially for collateral or to secure a loan that a traditional financial institution, is always going to be looking for. First and foremost, we have a lot more flexibility in terms of how we look at a borrower, how we look at a loan, how we structure a loan. So we've got that flexibility as a CDFI.
Jerry, are we just talking about neighborhood associations here, or can other folks apply for these loans as well, even for their own homes or to get into the business of rehabbing the house next door?
My short answer would be no, but I'm looking at Reuben for the real answer. Is that correct?
I think there are options, but we want to be the option for this program, given our partnership with Legal Aid and the work that we're both doing.
So you're focused on neighborhood associations, not on someone who just wants to fix up the house next door to them.
Yeah, we can look at typically small contractors. I mean, we lend to businesses. We don't make personal loans. We make small business loans. So mm-hmm. we ideally want to be working with a small contractor. But we have actually lent to a neighborhood group to do some home rehab. So we've already kind of made some rehab loans already, kind of got the ball rolling here. And so we're looking to hit the ground running now that we've launched this program.
Go ahead, Jerry.
Well, I wanted to add, we at Legal Aid, the attorneys at Legal Aid who work in the abandoned housing area, are vetting the rehabbers and the companies, the guys who are doing this work. These are, as Ruben said, very small businessmen, maybe one or two employees. So we vet those folks to be sure that they're going to do everything they're supposed to do to comply with the law. And then, of course, Ruben will work with them on the loans and providing some business financial education, I think, as well.
So there are some real business opportunities then for small contractors who want to work on the east side of Kansas City.
And there are.
Is there plenty of supply there?
Well, there are a number of rehabbers that we work with regularly, so there is a pool. I don't know how big it is, but there are a lot of these guys that are very well known to Legal Aid. They've worked on houses for years, and they do a good job, and we know they do a good job. So we will be vetting those folks and sending them on over to Ruben's AltCap to work on the loan process.
There's a real kind of empowerment story here. It's empowering neighborhoods to take back their neighborhoods, ensure that their neighborhoods are healthy, vibrant neighborhoods. It's empowering small businesses, you know, to help address this issue and grow their business by getting involved in home rehab work.
Are neighborhood associations already reaching out saying we want to get a piece of this action?
Yeah, we've worked with Ivanhoe Neighborhood Council. It was not necessarily a neighborhood association, but they work very closely in the Ivanhoe neighborhood on this issue and providing funding for them to address some home rehab issues in their neighborhood.
Whose idea was this, Ruben? Am I looking at the guy who came up with it, or is it you, or is it someone else?
You know, I think this is a marriage of, two really thoughtful, organizations in Kansas City that want to serve their community. And I think we all just came together with our specific expertise and came up with this idea.
You're referring to Legal Aid and AltCap.
Yeah.
How did they come together? What was the connection?
Yeah, I think like in anything, it's just
talked to somebody.
Relationships. Mm-hmm. We're all working kind of in the same field. There's a little overlap in some of the work that we do and some of the work that Legal Aid does.
Well, I want to throw out kudos to Greg Lombardi, who was our executive director up until the end of 2016, and Michael Duffy, an attorney who's been at Legal Aid for 30 or so years, maybe quite a bit longer. They are the guys who really put the package together, and then all of the legal work that had to be done, all the papering that had to be done, was done on a pro bono basis by lawyers at mm-hmm. the Stinson Law Firm mm-hmm. and Stinson Leonard Street, and they did a fabulous job. They put almost 350 hours of pro bono time into this. That's a lot of value in legal services, so it's a combination of people.
I was struck by the interest rates of some of these loans. These are short-term loans, I get that, but the interest rates, we're not talking 3%, we're 8, 9, 10%, right?
Yeah, up to 12%.
Why is that?
I think we're a lot of times working with small businesses who have, challenges with their credit. We've got some potential issues with securing our loans, with collateral. So we kind of have to price our risk to a certain extent with all of our loans, but we want to keep this to be, a very affordable product that we can offer small contractors.
What part of town are you going to be focusing in?
Well, it'll be on the inner, it'd be the inner core.
Is there a set of boundaries here, or is it just some sort of ease to truce?
It's going to be largely dependent on the neighborhood associations, I think, who are actively seeking
we've talked a lot about trying to focus in the urban neighborhood initiative area. So Diane Cleaver with UNI has really been promoting this vacant to vibrant.
That's the neighborhood initiative you're referring to, that Diane Cleaver, the wife of the congressman's involved with.
Exactly. Yeah. This is a chamber, Big Five effort, the UNI initiative. And Diane's really been promoting the vacant to vibrant effort, so trying to help address this vacancy issue in neighborhoods with homes.
There's sort of an added bonus here that we haven't talked about much yet, and that's the idea of affordable housing and making more of it available through this program. Is that where we're going here?
I think that's part of it. We're certainly not talking high-level, high-income housing. We're talking about affordable housing in neighborhoods where you know, the poverty is present. The incomes are not high. But, you know, there are lots of studies, Steve, have shown how important affordable housing and quality housing is to stability of children, of families. All of that.
That's beyond question, I think. Yeah.
And if you look at the ACEs tree, I like to talk about the adverse childhood experiences tree. There are all these impacts, and we think that we're going to be addressing some of those and bringing some stability to neighborhoods.
You know, Ruben, how much of a departure is this social investment pool from the work, the core work that AltCap does?
You know, I think it's very, very closely related. And, you know, Jerry mentioned earlier, you know, one thing with this effort that I think is really exciting is this idea of creating more opportunities for social impact investment in Kansas City. This is a growing field around the country where you have philanthropy, private investors, you know, really looking at opportunities to invest their funds into initiatives like this that can potentially have an economic return and a social return to them. But
you know, we mentioned Diane Cleaver's work with the Neighborhood Initiative. You know, there's the 1-8 cent sales tax on the east side, all kinds of talk in the community about other efforts that are underway as well. You do get a sense that there's a little mojo here suddenly behind efforts to give the east side a jump start that I haven't heard of in my time in this town.
Right.
Yeah, I think this is a game changer in a lot of ways. I mean, one, like we mentioned with the whole social investment, you know, opportunity or social impact investment opportunity, but also I think just this going back to this idea of kind of the urban acupuncture, really kind of small scale interventions to transform kind of the larger urban context in our community,
right,
and working on these, you know, 1-2 vacant abandoned homes in a neighborhood. You know, if we can grow that and you know, aggregate that, that can really transform entire neighborhoods and create very healthy, vibrant neighborhoods again.
I think if you look at the vote on the Healthy Homes Initiative that just occurred earlier this month, overwhelming vote in favor of that. The city is working on a new housing policy that will be rolling out later this year. I think
Congressman Cleaver's done a lot of work in this area.
You know, and I think, as you said, I think we're snowballing, and I think you're going to see more and more of this kind of effort. And one thing that I've been hopeful of, one of the things that I've wanted to do as president of the Legal Aid Board, is to get us out into the community more, more outreach. And what I see happening here is if you rehab one house on a block, that's incentive to fix up other houses on that block, and it's an incentive to bring other services
for the homeowners who actually live there.
For all the homeowners who live there. And I think it's going to have a real impact. It may, this is really idealistic, and it may be long range, but I think it can happen.
That's interesting. I want to thank Judge Jerry Vinters for coming in. He's chair of the Board of Directors of Legal Aid of Western Missouri. Ruben Alonzo, president of AltCap, has been so instrumental in working on this new Kansas City social investment pool. Thanks for the update. Keep up the good work. We sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll visit with Mark Edelman, who will talk to us about 40 years bringing Broadway to Kansas City. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, doctors discussed the known and perceived health effects of e-cigarettes. Some say vaping among high schoolers has reached epic levels. Hear more at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we'll take a jazz tour through Kansas City with an urban planning professor and the founder of an indie record label. That's part of the annual Charlie Parker celebration, which begins today. That's tomorrow. Today, tomorrow, on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, for 40 years, Mark Edelman has brought Broadway to Kansas City, and now he's retiring, although he's going out with a bang with a recently concluded run of Wizard of Oz that included several firsts, including what was believed to be the first professional musical theater production ever presented in Wyandotte County. And, of course, the business of luring touring Broadway shows to Kansas City, which Edelman perfected, will continue. So, Mark, welcome and congratulations on 40 years. That's quite an achievement.
Thank you, Steve. No, yeah. It's been fun. And we owe it all, of course, to our seasoned members and the staff that has diligently focused on that.
Well, 40 years is a long time. What was it about the theater that captivated you so much that you actually were willing to give up a longer career in the law to go do it?
Well, I'm a fan of sitting in lobbies at intermission. In fact, it always irritates me when the playwright doesn't write at intermission, doesn't write two acts. You know, there's something about people who don't know each other, who I'm sure come from different, not so much different walks of life, certainly different political perspectives.
Right.
And they get together and they share an experience that I'm not going to pretend it's transformative, but it brings, you know, new ideas to the fore, and more important, they're all sharing them. You know, they're all together.
But
they're,
you can get that from the movies. What was it about theater that got you?
Yeah, you really don't get it from the movie. Think about the movie experience. Yeah, you go into a dark room, sit there, people are chewing their popcorn. You really don't have the same kind of commitment to the experiences you do in the theater. And, of course, there are a lot more people in the theater if you're successful than in a movie theater anymore. Yeah, you're right. Once upon a time when the Empire and the Midland and the Capri, you know, you saw a movie with 1,000 people, that might have been the case. But there's very few places you can go and share that experience. Of course, sports franchises, you know, you can do that there.
Right.
But my experience in the theater was always, you know, the nice part about the theater is the team you're rooting for always wins.
You know, you were in law school here at UMKC when you saw a stage production that changed your life. What was it?
Well, actually, everything that Casey Rep, actually then Missouri Rep, and Dr. Pat McElrath did, and that was actually starting in high school. I grew up in Prairie Village and went to Shawnee Mission East, went away for college. But when I came back here, I would attend shows. An early show for me that really kind of captivated me, it was one that most people don't know. It was called, the shorthand was Marat Saad. It's a long title. It's a very weird play, but just the actors were like spitting in your face and things. And years later, I saw Nicholas Nickleby at the Rep and all those shows. I think a lot of people, I'm sure Cynthia Levin and a lot of other theater people here in Kansas City, Richard Carruthers and Dennis Hennessy, a lot of them grew up in that environment. I was further away than those guys were. I was more of an audience member, but it turned me on to the possibilities of theater.
But you didn't act yourself or sing. Why not?
I can't act or sing, and I thought I'd spare our audience.
And you know that about yourself.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You developed this idea of the theater league that had you bringing touring shows to Kansas City and lots of other cities as well. Where did the idea come from?
I read a book by a guy named Danny Newman called Subscribe Now. I'd gone away to New York to try to be an entertainment lawyer, but instead ended up running a small summer stock theater. The subscription model, the idea that a membership group would go to every show, would commit to a season, was getting popular then. It was also popularized by Sir Tyrone Guthrie in Minneapolis. But this guy, Danny Newman, wrote this book called Subscribe Now. And his point was, if you spend $99 to get somebody to buy a $100 season ticket, you know, they'll come back. So the next year, it only costs $1.50 to get them to spend that $100. And over the years, if you continue to provide quality entertainment, they'll continue to come back. And so that kind of got me going, that book.
You know, when you first got involved here, I think the idea was just to bring more shows to Kansas City and for longer runs. How big a gamble was it at the time to bring these shows to town, you know, for longer than just a night or two?
Well, it seemed like a lot then, but I recently went back and looked at the budget for Grease, the first show we ever presented in like 1977 at the Lyric Theater. The entire gross was less than the stagehand bill at the Kaufman now for a play. So it wasn't as dramatic as I thought. And people were going. People, you know, you ran an ad. The nice thing about my business, knock on wood, was no, there's no receivables. You know, people buy their ticket. In some cases, they buy the ticket 18 months before, you know, that particular show, you know, happened. So it gives us the stability to continue to build an organization.
How successful has it been?
I raised two kids, went to college.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have a house. You know, it's interesting that you asked that question. I mean, to have made a career in the theater, you know, and I have a lot of friends, and you do too, in Kansas City, for whom that was the case. I think being here was helpful. You know, living in a community like this, where you know the cost of living wasn't crazy. Yeah. You could get by. There's a lot of actors in Kansas City who live in a house, have a car, send their kids to school. You talk to their compatriots in L.A. and New York, and that is tough there. But you can get it done in Kansas City.
You told Bob Butler, who wrote a story in The Star about you and your upcoming retirement, these terrific tales of some of the stars you've worked with over the years.
although I'm not sure anybody remembers any of them now.
Well, that's why I'm bringing it up again here, because they were so good. How about the story with Desi Arnaz, the one-time husband of Lucille Ball?
My wife read that story and said he didn't jump on the table.
What did he do?
Well, the other interesting thing about that experience, we had dinner at the old Hereford House,
right,
and Larry Luckinbill, Lucy's husband, one of the only actors who ever picked up the check. Mostly you take them out and you're picking up the check.
Yeah.
Lucy's dad was there, and he had some drinks, and he was spurned on to sing Babaloo. And I do believe he got up. At least he got up and was singing that tune. But we've had a lot of, a lot of great people. Yul Brynner was at the Midland early in its day, and we, at his direction, painted the dressing room brown. And that was right before, actually, it was only about within a year he passed away. Mm. And he made the commercial, some people saw it, where he said, the commercial was basically, it was an anti-smoking commercial. And he said, by the time you see this, I'll be gone. I think he made that commercial in Kansas City, he knew.
Wow. Mark Edelman is my guest. He's retiring after 40 years from the theater league. How about a story involving Eartha Kitt, who suddenly decided that she liked the looks of a certain house on Ward Parkway and just decided to walk up to the door and walk into the house?
The other thing about Eartha was we went to a restaurant, and I think it was like the American, because they used to have a talk show down there that we would do. And the waitress came up and said, "What would you like?" And she said, "I'll have everything." she ordered the entire menu. And, of course, guess who paid for it?
She ordered the entire menu.
She said, I want everything. She said, "I'll have everything."
And she
but
ate,
she was a character. She ate a little bit off of every plate.
What were the top three or four shows that you brought to Kansas City over the years, in your view?
That's really tough,
because
there's shows that mean a lot to me. The ones that are touching, the ones that make me sob, I'm reminded of them more than the comedies, although the comedies are fabulous. The first time we did all the big hits, people talk about Hamilton now, and it is a dramatic success.
You're
it's amazing.
Bringing it next year,
right? It's coming. Well, I'm not. I'm the American Theater Guild, which is an organization that's basically created by our staff, the young people on our staff.
Right.
They're going to be running the Kansas City Broadway series under the direction of Amy Hamm, who's actually been primarily responsible for our success these last 5-10 years. Amy and Debbie Davis, Bethany Nesbitt, they're going to be running it. But people talk about Hamilton. Wow, I've never seen anything like it. Well, in 1977, actually 78, we did 3 weeks of a play called A Chorus Line, and you couldn't get a ticket. People were calling. There had been many years since there was a show ran for 3 weeks in Kansas City.
Yeah.
And, that was followed, 5, 7, 8 years later by Annie, then Cats, then Les Mis, then Phantom. I was lucky to have had a career that followed not only the Renaissance, but the explosion of interest in musical theater.
So what is the state of affairs of musical theater today? How healthy is it?
Oh, really healthy. I mean, I look at the shows coming down the pike. I remember the Broadway League, so I see all the shows that open on Broadway. We're lucky in that so many of the other performing arts organizations, they're by definition, they're mostly recycling Mozart and Stravinsky and the classics, the greats. But as opposed to the symphony, the opera, and the ballet, the theater, particularly the musical theater, we have all these vibrant new shows. I mean, the biggest musical, Hamilton, has hip hop in it, and new shows like Dear Evan Hansen, Come From Away. So the shows, there's a show based on Jagged Little Pill the album, the Alanis Morissette album. All these new and exciting things are really much, you know, they represent a younger group of artists, and that for that reason, I think we have a lot to look forward to in musical theater.
I'm visiting with Mark Edelman. If you could watch one performer, I'm going to try this again now, Mark, for one night, who would it be?
Well, I was a huge fan of Julie Harris. She passed away, but she blew me away. Probably. That's a tough one. I mean, seeing Lin-Manuel do Hamilton was pretty special. But there's actors in Kansas City, you know, that yeah. you know blow your mind when you see them in the right work with the right material. So you know, it's always an exciting experience because actors are putting it on the line.
How soon did you recognize that Hamilton was going to become the phenom that it became?
Well, the producer is a guy who used to be like the agent who called me and said, "Would you buy a show?" So I've known him for years and years. You know, I saw a piece in a blog or at something online that mentioned the Hamilton mixtapes and that Lin was doing something at the White House for Obama. And, you know, I saw that and went, you know, that really kind of sounds interesting. I mean, everybody else says, come on, a musical about Alexander Hamilton.
Right.
But, you know, it's great source material. What's neat about that show is that it's not only, you know, of the moment, you know, culturally and musically, but it's a great story about these, I mean, it's wacky, these 20-something kids, you know, who would, you know, check out Chicks on the Way Down. You know, I mean, they were just, you know, they were young people. They created this country.
Yeah. To what extent is Hamilton sort of changing the game for musicals in this country? Is it a game changer? Are you seeing new ideas come out of it, or was that just a singular?
Yeah, I don't think you're going to see a lot of hip hop musicals. I mean, I think that's Lin's, you know, lingua franca, and he's going to do that. Other people are doing it too, but it's just that everybody's very excited about musical theater, and there's a younger audience coming. Social media is like embracing musical theater because it's a group of people who are like minded, who are intense, passionate about something. There's a show off Broadway now called Be More Chill that you probably haven't heard of. I mean, I have no idea what it is, but it is selling out places with no advertising because it's been online. It's literally all these songs have been online. It's about young people working their way through junior high and high school. And people are lining up for it in New York now. So, you know, watch for that. That's going to be kind of an exciting thing to come. But it's an opening and opportunity for new creative artists to get involved.
You know, you went out with this breakthrough production of A Wizard of Oz. How was that received?
We didn't get the audience we had hoped to. It was a bit disappointing. I think people...
Why? It's A Wizard of Oz.
I know.
It
see,
seems
see
like
if I knew that, I'd,
yeah.
I'd be more successful than I am. I think that people, you know, I mean, people didn't associate musical theater and family events with that theater. You know, I mean, it's we all know it. I mean, I saw Tom Petty and Steely Dan and Paul Simon there, but it didn't, I think it didn't, you know, cross over. There are other activities. The weather was a little hot before, lots of things to blame it on. It was a great production. Michael and Andy Grayman Parkhurst did a terrific job. We had a wonderful cast using this video wall, this 40-foot video wall.
And these stills from the original movie.
Yeah, that really worked
nicely. That was the first.
That had never happened before. And it really worked nicely. You know, you'd see, especially once it got dark, you know, you see, you know, that tracking shot into Munchkin Land. You see the little pink ball, you know, float down, and then bang, out of smoke comes Glinda the Good Witch.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool. I think everyone who came, I think, really enjoyed it. In fact, I think we're pleasantly surprised the work. And it's a lovely place out there. The other nice thing that was created out of this is we got some theater into the Ag Hall, which is right next door. They did a program called Oz Comes to Kansas, and the Messner Puppets did their own version of Wizard of Oz out there. I'm hoping that's going to spawn some more interest in doing plays and things in Wyandotte County, which is, of course, an important part of our metropolitan area.
You had talked before the run of A Wizard of Oz of hopefully making this something of an annual deal. Are those plans off, or are you still looking at it?
I don't think there was enough interest in it.
Wasn't enough
interest. I'm disappointed to say it. And, never say never in our business. Perhaps somebody else smarter than me can come up with it. Again, I think it was a great production. We just did not get enough folks to attend. And it's not going to get any cooler in the summertime.
No, you think not, eh? But yeah. You also came up with this idea for a show called 12th Street Jump, the jazz comedy show that airs here on KCUR at midnight on Saturday nights. Why did you want to do it?
You know, I'm a fan of jazz.
Yeah.
I listened to Prairie Home Companion. We once presented when we were running the Midland Theater. We did a Prairie Home Companion date, and I knew Prairie Home Companion, but the response to that show on the part of the ticket buying public was impressive. So I said, if we could create like the urban Prairie Home Companion with Kansas City jazz, make it Kansas City centric. We don't have Garrison Keillor, but maybe there's another way to approach this. It's sort of musical theater, so it was kind of up our alley. 15 years ago, I started walking around talking about this. Congressman Cleaver, who was very involved at the time down there, he said, that sounds cool. And now we're about to go into our 10th year of doing this. We're on 50 stations around the country. I mean, I wish there were more. When we started out, I thought, everybody's going to want this. Radio is not that easy. It was really been difficult. But we now have 50 stations that pay us. So, any given, night, and they don't all play it at midnight. It goes up on PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and stations pull it down when they want to. But, I got to figure every week, even if 200 people are listening to it, that's 10,000 people listening to, live from, Kansas City, where, where Basie Tickled the Ivories and Big Joe Turner Shadowed the Blues. It's Kansas City.
Yeah.
So, that was an idea that appealed to me. It's been fun doing it.
And the concept of the show has been met with some sort of mixed reactions out there.
Well, we've had stations that turn us down because it's political. And our politics, I wouldn't call it left or right. We go after hypocrisy. I mean, we went after Anthony Weiner.
Yeah.
We had a lot of fun with him. It's a lot like, sketch comedy. But nowadays, most of the jokes are about our current administration.
How are you going to stay connected to the theater going forward? How's that going to work for you?
Well, the Theater League continues to be, an organization. The presenting model is taken over by this new group, the American Theater Guild, under A.B. Hamm's direction. But we continue to we're involved. We're a significant contributor to arts organizations in Kansas City, theater companies.
Mm-hmm.
We have something called Theater Rocks, Reach Out to Kids, where we pay for tickets for kids to see not only our shows, but actually mostly shows at The Rep, The Unicorn, Messner Puppets, TYA, The Coterie is, a big group. We work with The Lynx, a social service organization that identifies kids who we take to the theater. So we'll continue to do all that, probably ramp that up a bit, and then, work on other projects that where our background and funding can be of help.
Man, you got the energy of a 20-year-old. You're just spouting ideas here. I mean, listen to you. Mark Edelman, congratulations on a sterling career with the Theater League. Thanks for coming and sharing with us your memories, and good luck down the road.
Steve, keep up your good work. We need this station.
Appreciate it, Mark. Coming up next, Brian McTavish will give us his weekend to-do list.
The world is a vampire. Sent to drain. Secret destroyers. Hold you up to the flames. And why do I get for my pain? Betrayed desires. And a piece of the game.
I'd know that group anywhere. That's the Smashing Pumpkins, and Brian McTavish is smashing, dressed in his T-shirt today to talk about some cool stuff to do on your weekend. Welcome back.
Thank you. Welcome back to me as well. I've got my Smashing Pumpkins facial stubble going.
There you go.
Even more so than normal.
Are you going tonight?
I am going tonight.
Sprint Center, 7 o'clock, Smashing Pumpkins.
Let's go.
Yes.
Okay. Frontman Billy Corrigan and crew dive into three decades full.
They've been around that long.
1988, Chicago.
Wouldn't have guessed it. Wouldn't have guessed it.
I would have thought longer. Because he sings with such an imbued sense of urgency.
Right.
Nutsoness. Like, I mean, despite all my rage, I am still just a rat in a cage.
Yes.
Bummer. Anyway, three decades of this great catalog of, you know, kind of uncharacteristically anthemic-friendly alternative rock.
They've
influenced a lot over the years, a lot of these acts, right? Where you can squirm to them, you can fidget to them, you can sing along to them. But what the Pumpkins do, especially tonight, three-hour-plus show, 7 tonight, Sprint Center, is they magnify, they make symphonic the alternative rock song. It's like over the top. Have a great time, and it's supposed to just look stunning. I can't wait to have it actually happen.
And weeks pass, and months pass, seasons fly. Still you don't walk through my door.
Sounds nice.
Give me one more.
That was a
twofer.
Andrew Lloyd Webber's Broadway sequel to The Phantom of the Opera, Love Never Dies.
Love Never Dies. Yeah. It's on stage tonight through Sunday at Starlight Theater, and I don't want to judge, although I've been known to judge.
Yes, you have.
In the past, I have done this from time to time. But Love Never Dies is the name of the sequel to the ridiculously successful Phantom of the Opera on Broadway. But why Love Never Dies? I thought love faded. This is where you, like, correct me.
No, it never dies.
Did I get that wrong?
Yes, you did.
Well, let me check my notes. Hold on.
Hang with it.
Oh, I see here.
Get
yes.
Get with the program.
It gets stronger. I got you. No, indeed, love never dies. The right kind of love.
Yes, the right kind of love.
Which is the way I would put it parenthetically. So what happened to the Phantom of the Opera, Steve, after the end of the Phantom of the Opera on Broadway?
That's what you're going to find
out here. Well, I think he initially took some time off, because that was a lot of performances on the Great White Way. But yes, so now the action picks up 10 years later in the early 20th century. Somehow, don't ask why, although you might be told, the Phantom winds up on Coney Island in New York.
No kidding.
No kidding. All the better to bring his estranged love, which he was really crazy, mean, nutso in love with, bring her over and her husband and their child to Coney Island. I don't think good things are going to happen except the good sounds coming out of the Phantom's mouth and others. Love Never Dies at Starlight.
Be sure to see Brian Six. Whatever happened to things to do in Kansas City this weekend, just go to kcur.org. You folks over the age of 60, listen up, because you're going to be interested in this item coming up here. This is amazing.
Over the age of 60, well, you've told the tale.
Look who's coming in here.
I'm going to let you say it. Say the names.
The Turtles, Chuck Negron.
Yeah.
And Three Dog Night, Mark Lindsay of Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Right.
The Association, Gary Puckett, and the Union Gap, all here Sunday night at the Kauffman Center.
Sunday night, 7 o'clock, Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. And who's singing this? This is Paul Revere and the Raiders. Is it 1966 still?
Sounds like it.
It will be Sunday night at the Kauffman Center. And that's Mark Lindsay.
So Mark Lindsay will be here. Mark Lindsay.
The Mark Lindsay.
Who was a big, big cover boy back in the day.
He was the teen beat pin-up prince, right?
Does he still look like Mark Lindsay?
Let me check my notes. Absolutely looks like Mark Lindsay.
Let's
absolutely.
Go with that.
Let's see. Chuck Negron, you mentioned he was of Three Dog Night. So you'll get Joy to the World. You'll get Kicks. You'll get The Association's Never My Love. You'll get Gary Puckett's Young Girl. You'll get the Cowsills, or what's left of them, singing And As Soon As You Hear This, which you won't hear. But when you go and you hear The Rain, The Park, and Other Things, you will go, my gosh, it's a long time ago again. It'll be fantastic. Yeah, now, tickets are hard to come by, limited availability.
Are they sold out?
Yeah, that's right. All the old folks have, most of them.
They've made a rush.
They've made a rush, and they're tired, and they're waiting to get in right now for Sunday night show. Anyway, I wish you all luck, and have a great time living way back when. I was running crazy. I was running wild. Living on the edge. Yeah, I was living in style. My hands start shaking like the streets of Hollywood. My mind was wasted. I still did the best I could. One day I left town.
Boy, that sounds good.
Oh, yeah, it kind of does.
What do we got here?
Well, that's Lita Ford.
Lita Ford.
Lita Ford, who with Joan Jett were two of the members of the four all-girl rock and roll
she's got pipes
kind of band.
Yeah.
Remember the Runaways, late 70s, big thing in L.A., never really made much out of that. They weren't really appreciated at the time, but they were kind of a proto, they used to call them girl bands, I didn't call them that, all-female band. You can catch Lita Ford, who was the lead guitarist with the Runaways, at 8 o'clock Friday night at the Voodoo Lounge at Harrah's Casino. I mean, even though, let's face it, Joan Jett, you know, she had the bigger career. She's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She even flirted with movie stardom opposite Michael J. Fox in that flick, you might have seen it, Light of Day, where she actually plays a Joan Jett-type rock star. Anyway, Lita didn't do any of that, but she did have a duet, Close My Eyes Forever, with Ozzy Osbourne.
Mm.
You can sing Ozzy's part Sunday at her show.
And finally today, and
fun.
This is
Family Fun.
Wow.
Family Fun. It's back. Did it ever leave? Parkville Days Festival. It's Friday, Saturday, Sunday, down there on the Missouri River in downtown Parkville.
Love English, stuff like that. Love stuff like
that. Well, you can just kind of, a guy like you, you just kind of like waft in, right? You have a corn dog.
Yeah.
You pet a couple kids on the head.
Yeah.
They recognize you. You say thanks and you go home.
Yes.
Right? But I'll stay. I'm staying for the carnival. I'm staying for the live bands, the helicopter rides. No, but I'll try a pony ride if they let me on, and they won't. There's a parade Saturday morning, a pancake breakfast Saturday morning, and martial arts demos. It's a weekend of fun. Parkville Days down by the river in downtown Parkville.
That's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thank you.
Oh, it's your weekend to-do list.
Tomorrow we meet with school leaders in Kansas City to ask about their opposition to the mayor's pre-K sales tax proposal. Follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.